The Senate Committee on Education and General Government. And today, we'd like to begin a little bit out of order. In fact, today is going to be a little bit of a jumble. We'd like to begin with a public hearing on Senate Bill 366. Senator Walker, I believe, is in the audience. And if she can make her way to the testimony table. And Dana, if you could read us a summary.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 366 replaces the existing prohibition on school districts, ESDs, and public charter schools from entering into contracts with administrators providing compensation for work not performed. You'll note on your staff measure summary there's a typo. It declares invalid and unenforceable. So not valid and unenforceable. School districts, ESD, and public charter school contracts are collective bargaining agreements with administrators if it's contained compensation beyond elements that are specified in statute. It does declare an emergency and would take effect upon passage, and I'm sure Senator Walker will give you a more in-depth overview than I have done.
Senator Walker, thank you for joining us, and if you could set the stage a little bit for this bill.
Okay.
What passed last session, what happened, what you're hoping to do with this legislation.
All right, thank you. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7, and all of you are very well aware of how frustrated I've become over the golden parachute bill, as we like to call it. These are my bill files from, this is my third session now. The first session, it was Senate Bill 766. The second session, it was Senate Bill 384. That was last session. And now we have Senate Bill 366. Interesting, we have two 666s in there. But so that must mean something. I'm not sure what. Add another six, and it will tell you where we're going today. But I'm quite frustrated because this was supposed to put an end to the settlement agreements that people would walk out the door, superintendents would walk out the door with golden parachutes. And as you know, in the interim, we had a hearing actually in this interim committee on October 27th of 2008. I have my notes here in front of me. We had Chuck Bennett, David Williams, and Jim Brown, the lawyer who orchestrated these settlement agreements, here testifying about why they did meet the letter of the law. So the letter of the law, let me refresh you, in 2007, we said that you could not enter into an employment agreement with a superintendent and give them anything at the end for work that is not performed. Now, you can give them health insurance until they get another job or until they reach age 65, and for a period of 1 year after the termination of the contract, you couldn't purchase property or those kinds of things. So what happened is the Reynolds School District got rid of their superintendent because he wasn't very good, as usually happens, and he walked out with $133,000, 1 year's annual salary. Well, you'll notice in my revised bill here, 366, I say you can give him 1 year's salary, but they gave him more than that. They gave him a car. They let him continue to lease a car with the district, and I'm thinking, wait a minute, why are you doing that when he doesn't even work for the district anymore? This is silly. This is taxpayer money. And I don't know if any of you are aware, but Reynolds School District's in a lot of trouble, significant trouble. Even the money we gave them, the stimulus money, didn't even come close to fixing the hole that they have. Additionally, the Lebanon School District, and the car allowance was $412 a month, by the way. And then since that superintendent has been sent, someone has charged the superintendent with inappropriate use of taxpayer money while superintendent, and it's the case has been sent to the Ethics Commission, as you know. But that's only allegations. It's not been proved. And then, as Senator Morse knows, the Lebanon School District entered a buyout about the same period of time for about $400,000. So, you know, it was just too much for me. And I asked these gentlemen when I was sitting in your chair, Mr. Chair, how could you do this? How did you get around the law? Well, they got around the law because they terminated the employment contract. And once the employment contract is terminated, you can enter into any settlement agreement you want. So what did we do is what I'm asking myself. What did we do if you can just terminate the employment contract that, you know, meets the terms and conditions of the bill we passed last session, if you can just terminate the employment contract and then just enter into a new agreement? So henceforth, we have Senate Bill 366, and it says in pertinent part down in Section 1 on lines 25 through 27, provisions you can enter into a contract, provisions of a collective bargaining agreement, individual employment contract, agreement for resignation or termination, severance agreement, or any other contract. I tried to throw in the kitchen sink on this one because I'm just tired of having people do an end run around me, which has been happening today with other issues. And then you go to the back page, and we have the same information about work performed. You can only pay them for work performed. You pay them their accumulated unused sick leave, accumulated retirement benefits. We want to take that from them. I'm not interested in that. And then severance pay may not exceed 12 months of pay. Now, I know, I can hear it already. I can feel the eyes burning in the back of my head that the superintendents will say, we can't hire a superintendent if they know their job is only 1 year. Even though contracts by law are 3 years, if you have a severance agreement where you can only pay out 1 year, they're not going to get a superintendent to sign up, or so they say. But the other pertinent part is that on lines 13 through 16 on page 2 in subsection 4, a member of a school district board, education service district board, or public charter school board must abstain from the process of entering into a contract or agreement described in subsection 3 if the member has received notice that the member has been named in a proceeding involving the administrator. Why is that important? That was a situation in Lebanon. Two of the school board members, the superintendent had served notice, a tort claim notice, against two of the school board members. So these two school board members entered into the agreement for the settlement agreement that would dismiss claims against them, as well as give a chunk of change to the exiting superintendent. I don't feel that the district, the citizens of the district were well represented in that, because you had two members of the board who had a big, huge conflict of interest because they didn't want to be sued. And, you know, the district would probably indemnify them, but nonetheless, they had an interest in, a personal interest in wanting to see that settled. So I threw that piece in there. So we've got the kitchen sink now. We've got the Drano. So now I'm going to give you the plug. And the plug says you can't lease or own property from the school district once you've been terminated, because that would take care of the superintendent in the Reynolds School District who's leasing a car. So my fury has been unleashed in Senate Bill 366 because I'm just trying to solve this problem for the state of Oregon and for these school districts who don't have this kind of money to be throwing away. And, you know, maybe they should make better choices about hiring superintendents, but maybe they get them there and it's just not quite the right fit. I don't know what the deal was. I know what the deal was in Lebanon because Senator Morrison and I have talked about it, but I don't know what the deal was in Reynolds. I don't know how that person was able to function in that district for so long and make so many mistakes and get that district so far in debt. I know they've got an attentive school board. I just don't know what happened in that situation. So I'm just trying to protect the taxpayer, and that's what this bill is here about, Mr. Chair. I'm here if you have any questions.
Senator, thank you. Senator Morris?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Walker, thank you for coming today. The question I would have is, in the event that you have a normal, if there is such a thing, relationship between a superintendent and his board, and there is a contract of employment that is a multi-year contract, and there arises actions on the part of the board that are really damaging to the superintendent, and you then have a subsequent tort claim, how would this bill relate in that instance?
Mr. Chair and Senator Morris, the contract for a superintendent is 3 years by statute. And so if we implemented this bill and a superintendent came in and lasted about 6 months, under this bill, would only be able to pay them a year, which is in conflict with the 3 year contract that they can enter into by law. So we would basically be saying you can't enter into 3 year contracts, and I think that's what the folks are going to be testifying to. COSA will probably testify to that, would be my guess.
As a follow up, Mr. Chair, Do we have an opinion that, in fact, this language would supersede tort law?
I don't, Mr. Chair and Senator Morse, I don't have an opinion about that. I have one opinion in my hand from November 5th, 2008, where I asked for an interpretation of the words employment contract and what that meant. And the answer that came back is that the term employment contract means the terms and conditions of employment and may be limited by an established period of time. The term most likely would not include a settlement agreement or other agreement entered into for the purpose of terminating employment. Hence, the reason for my bill before you is you can put all you want into the statute about what you can and cannot put in an employment contract. But once you terminated it, it's done, and because you enter into a settlement agreement, and we aren't putting parameters around a settlement agreement, and that's the piece that's missing, and I'm just tired of tugging the little rat hole. I mean, just, you know, the more cheese you give them, the more mice you have come out of the rat hole, and it's just frustrating for me because I know the superintendents try to do a good job, but sometimes the fit's wrong, sometimes it's the board, sometimes it's the soup, sometimes it's a combination of the two, sometimes it's just not a good fit, period. But you have to have a way to terminate that agreement without giving away the taxpayers' money in the process. I see a certain amount of the money that needs to go with it because it's a contract, but for heaven's sakes, you know, again, we get back to the car, and this is what we were trying to do away with before, Willamette ESD. He got to buy a vehicle at less than its Blue Book value, and, you know, that made everybody mad, and you should have seen the letters to the editor that were in the Statesman Journal and other papers. So that's what we were trying to get to, and I think we did, and then we saw what happened, how you can just spin that. Lawyers know how to do that very well. I respect lawyers, but, you know, this is not what I intended, and I don't think it's what you intended when you all supported this bill when I chaired this committee, and I think Senator Hass was part of our committee at that time.
Senator Cruz?
Senator Cruz's eyebrows are furrowed, so he's thinking.
Yeah, he's in that furrowed brow stage. There's
yes.
A question brewing in there. Let me ask you, Senator Walker, we have a celebrated or high-profile case in Clackamas County now involving a county government executive, a county administrator, who resigned and got a $100,000 severance package. He resigned and got this. It was one of those deals. So I'm just wondering, this is obviously limited to schools, and, you know, why, I guess the devil's advocate would be, why just schools? If this makes good sense, why not higher education, why not county government? Because some of the same principles that you're talking about or complaining about, you know, exist in other layers of government.
Well, Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. I'll give you the smart aleck answer. This relating clause is relating to employment conditions of school administrators. That's the sort of flip answer. Simply, that's been my focus. And I agree with you, in other areas of government, people should be standing up and protesting this. I think taxpayers are so tired of what they see as a waste of their money. And in these tight economic times, particularly, and you know the whole thing with AIG and the federal government not minding the store, that was ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous, that someone didn't know these people were getting all these bonuses. And so I'm just trying to make sure that we know what bonuses or buyouts are coming down the pike, and that we put some parameters around them. That's all I'm asking, is we put some parameters around them so that Oregonians don't feel like they've been had. Nobody likes to feel like they've been had. It's a very unpleasant feeling.
Right. I agree with that. Any other questions? Senator Cruz now has one.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Walker, I'm just wondering if we... I mean, you're one... sub 4, lines 13 through 16 on page 2. If if a proceeding, if the administrator initiated a proceeding involving four school board members, then you have a quorum issue, don't you?
Then, Mr. Chair and Senator Cruz, who makes the determination?
Yeah. That would just be a question. I mean, you know, if we're trying to avoid games people play, wouldn't that kind of set up a games people play scenario potentially?
Mr. Chair and Senator Cruz, you've got me on that one, I agree with you. I hadn't thought that out completely, because I was just still thinking of the Lebanon case.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right, and I think in that situation you'd have to appoint a special committee to review the settlement agreement. Who would make the appointment? Certainly not the superintendent.
I mean, if I could follow up, I'm assuming that the litigation could be a tool used to arrive at a decision.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're setting up here would render the board ineffective, potentially. So I think that's something that needs to be considered, that we aren't setting up that sort of scenario.
That's Mr. Chair and Senator Cruz, that's a very good point. And it's certainly one of the points that I'm happy to work on to make better.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Chair.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator Walker.
All right, thank you. I've got to go to committee, so my staff is ably taking notes of anyone who testifies. So if you think I take good notes, just know that my staff does as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We are going to zig and zag here for a second and temporarily close this hearing on Senate Bill 366, and we will move into a public hearing on Senate Bill 633. And while we are waiting for John Turner, Ben Westland, Jen Pete, and Bob Livingston to take the table as a panel, Dana will read us a summary.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 633 directs the Oregon Investment Council and the State Treasurer to ensure that subject investment funds are not invested in any company that the Council knows is doing business in Iran or is owned or controlled by the government of Iran. It directs the Council and the Treasurer to investigate all companies in which the Council has invested subject investment funds to determine whether any of those companies are doing business in Iran or are controlled or owned by the government of Iran. It does provide some exceptions for three specific types of companies. It requires an annual report by the State Treasurer to the Legislative Assembly on the implementation of the Act, and it declares an emergency would take effect upon passage.
Okay. This is the Iran divestiture bill. It is sponsored by Boquist and Atkinson, and we will hear from them later. But now we have the Treasurer's Office. And
the Chair House, members of the committee, my name is John Turner, and I believe the Treasurer is on his way down, so I will expedite this as he arrives. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Turner. I'm here today to oppose Senate Bill 633 as a private citizen, but also as a former legislative staffer who worked integrally on the Sudan divestment legislation that the Oregon legislature passed in 2005. I know that Treasury staff will lay out a number of important reasons why this divestment proposal is bad policy and other considerations for your benefit, but I just want to take a moment to provide a little history that explains why this issue before you today is different than that which was considered in 2005 and why it doesn't meet the strict test for divestment. First of all, divestiture is a very blunt tool, and liquidating investments ends any hope of further engaging companies and leveraging stockholder power to create an opportunity for social, corporate, and political change. There are a number of other effective investment tools that can be used to change corporate practices and governance policy, including proxy voting and direct shareholder-to-corporation communication. Because Oregon maintains a significant stock portfolio in its many investment funds, including the Public Employees Retirement Fund, we have the opportunity to utilize our strong market position to form coalitions and effect great change in domestic and international corporations. In this case of Iran policy, we're only talking about international corporations, since domestic companies have been prohibited from doing business with and in Iran since the 1980s. The situation, as I said, in Iran is much different than that with Sudan. In Sudan, we can draw a direct line from international business activities to the funding of state-sponsored militias committing genocide. In Sudan, about 70% of the oil revenues from foreign drilling companies is spent on supplying and outfitting a disproportionately large and well-equipped military that operates in the Darfur region. Very little of the business fees and taxes that are collected are ever spent outside of the capital region where government supporters reside, let alone spent on services that benefit the general population as a whole. Government revenues from these contracts are spent on military power that is used to kill, rape, pillage, destroy, and displace hundreds of thousands of poor nomadic people in the Darfur region, as I've said, so that the area will be clear for oil drilling. In 2000, as you probably well know, the president of Sudan announced his intention to use oil revenues to build a domestic arms industry, and has been confirmed that he later purchased tanks and attack helicopters from Russia. It was morally reprehensible that Oregon's investment funds were invested in companies including PetroChina and Sinopec, whose activities and financial support to the Sudan regime directly led to the mass killing and displacements of hundreds of thousands of innocent people. It should also be noticed that since Oregon was the third state in the country to divest from Sudan, 27 states, 23 major cities, and 61 universities followed suit. And finally, the president of Sudan was recently indicted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes and crimes against humanity in perpetrating these genocides in Darfur. And there is, however, no clear case or direct connection between international business activities and atrocities being committed by the Iranian government. Certainly, the saber-rattling and international aggression by the government of Iran is unacceptable, and our leaders in Washington will be employing effective diplomacy and pressure to bring the country into the community of nations. However, the foreign policy of Iran certainly does not constitute such a clear and direct case for divestment as Sudan does. Finally, when Oregon considered divestiture in 2005, there were valid slippery slope questions which were raised about whether Sudan divestment would lead to other socially responsible investment practices and policies. And proponents at that time specifically outlined their support for this extreme measure, since there was literally blood on our investment dollars. The threshold for divestment was drawn at genocide, and I hope that those goalposts are not moved today. I hope that the proponents of Senate Bill 633 and other divestment bills would continue to work with the Treasury Department on acceptable investment policies with regard to Iran, like proxy voting and direct corporate engagement, and appropriately leave divestment as a tool of last resort in extreme circumstances. Thank you for your time, and I urge the committee to oppose Senate Bill 633.
Thank you. Questions? Mr. Morris?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would like to refer to the statement that we have an opportunity to utilize our strong market position to form coalitions and affect great change in domestic and international corporations. Could you share with me some examples of where we have indeed affected change in domestic and international corporations?
Chair Haas and Senator Morris, I could not specifically provide you with an example, but I'm sure the Treasury Department could do that for you. I'm specifically thinking of proxy voting and direct corporate shareholder to corporation communication. I know that they do that. I cannot provide a specific example for you right now.
Okay. The Treasurer is with us. Treasurer Westland, would you mind joining us? We have your letter. Don't feel the need to read it. But perhaps you could address Senator Morris's question and highlight your opposition.
For the record, State Treasurer Ben Westland, and also with me is our head of corporate governance, Jen Peet, who is also performs a very important legal function, not just in terms of this issue, but many other issues that come before the Treasurer's office. And if you would like us to answer Senator Morris's question first, I'd be happy to turn it over to Jen to give you a more complete answer than I could provide at this moment. Although, so if I could do that.
I think the first example that comes to mind is in...
For the record,
Chair Haas, and it
Jen
was
Pete.
Senator Morse. My name is Jennifer Pete. I'm on staff for the Treasurer. I'm his corporate governance officer and responsible for the Sudan divestment program and for the work that we're doing on the Iran divestiture bill. I think the first example that you... I should restate the question you asked, if there are examples where coalitions of shareholders have brought about change.
Well, if I may take the liberty, Mr. Chair, of just reading from the previous testimony, because Oregon maintains a significant stock portfolio and its many investment funds, we have the opportunity to utilize our strong market position to form coalitions and effect great change in domestic and international corporations. And my question was if we could cite examples where we have, in fact, affected change.
Through coalitions, yes. The first example, pardon me, that comes to mind is in the area of executive compensation, where you're reading about a decline in averages, anyway, just in the last couple of years. And we feel that those are the result of a great deal of shareholder pressure, and a lot of that pressure comes through coalitions of larger institutional investors, including public pension funds.
There are others in terms of you can go down the list in almost in any area. You look at greenhouse gases emissions, corporate sustainability models. There is an increasing influence with regard to, and this is fundamental, influence by the people that own the company, not the board of directors. It's not the president. It's not the officers. It's the shareholders. And that kind of common sense standard right legal status is being asserted not just on, you know, this type of issue with regard to divestiture, but with regard to a whole myriad of issues that really run the gamut. I mean, people that own the company that have a profit motive that drives their ownership, you know, are concerned about, in the broad sense, corporate governance issues, sustainability models, compensation, fairness, return on investment, shareholders playing an increasingly active and significant role in the management of the company.
Treasurer Westland, did you want to make your case and follow your...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, State Treasurer Ben Westland and I am here to testify. I don't want to say reluctantly, but here to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 633. Let me state clearly that I affirm the values as reflected in the bill. I understand where the many good-hearted, well-intended, very sincere advocates for this bill are coming from. Absolutely. Really, this is for me a question, you know, of not what we do, but how we do it. And I genuinely feel, you know, that there are better ways to do this that continues to gain not only a higher public profile for these issues, and specifically with regard to Iran, but also a more effective way of voicing opposition to things that are going on in Iran. And it's really kind of simple, and part of the bill calls for this, and I compliment this part of the bill, the ongoing dialogue with some of these companies. We are more than happy to do that, and indeed is really the point that I would like to put on this discussion is if we divest, we sell our assets, that conversation is over. There is no continuing opportunity to continue to highlight these issues, and the discussion is over. That's really one of my biggest concerns. I think there are legal issues, and We've highlighted those in our letter. I don't know if you need me to, you know, go through those again if you have any specific legal questions. Ms. Pete, being a a practicing attorney, would be more comprehensive in her answer to those. But this is not an opinion we've arrived at casually or a position that we take lightly. Like I say, I affirm without reservation hesitation the values in this bill and what the proponents are trying to achieve. Simplest terms, I just think there's a not just a better, but a much better way to do it.
Other questions? Senator Morris?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm probably not alone in this hearing room as the only person that watched 60 Minutes last night. And it was a feature with respect to a protester in Iran and consequent actions of the government towards him. So it's hard to have warm, fuzzy feelings about Iran. But I'm wondering, the bill addresses two things, and essentially this is a secondary boycott. I don't see it as an attempt to punish, so to speak, the companies that do business, as opposed to, through the secondary boycott, so to speak, affect Iran to where you sufficiently isolate it to where maybe it would, in fact, change its internal as well as international policies. But the bill addresses companies that the council knows is doing business in Iran or is owned or controlled by the government of Iran. And I'm wondering how you would feel about language specific to owning or controlled by the government of Iran.
Let me just reiterate one point I've made and then turn that question over to Ms. Pete. But in no way, shape, or form do I feel that Iran is a good collaborative member of the community of nations, that they don't have expansionistic hegemony type goals in the Middle East, at least in the Middle East. I am very concerned about the political stance, posture, and actions going on in Iran. With regard to your second question, let me turn that over to Ms. Pete and let her more comprehensively answer. I didn't see the show, Senator, so maybe I'd be...
You would not be very happy.
Yeah, I believe that.
Chair Haas and Senator Morse, I didn't see the show either, but I am familiar with the situation that you were talking about. And the question is how we would feel about language that speaks to property that's owned or controlled by the government of Iran. And that would be fine. That language is consistent with federal sanctions that are already in place, and so we already are not permitted to invest, nor is any domestic company, no U.S. company, is permitted to invest in or contribute in that way to the nation of Iran. So that's consistent with our current situation.
Yeah, and this is an important point. It's my firm understanding that we are in complete compliance with existing federal law.
Thank you.
Yeah, not inconsequentially, we're in compliance with federal law.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Treasurer, Ms. Pete, for your testimony. I was looking at the staff measure summary, and it appears that at least 12 other states have already passed similar legislation, and they appear to sort of run the gamut in terms of size and geography and that kind of thing. I wonder, are you aware of any challenges that have been made in those states? Because I know, Mr. Treasurer, you said that you expected that there could be some challenges.
Two points, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici. Two points. One, I am certainly not familiar with their particular constitutional or statutory legal requirements within those existing states. And I do not know the type of funds, the classification of fund, the corpus from which these type of assets were divested from. The short answer to your question is I am not, but each of those states would have to be taken on their own individual merits. You know, what are their constitutional statutory requirements, and then what type of fund? You know, the simple statement is were they funds other than, I don't know that they were, I don't know that they weren't, other funds other than public employee retirement funds.
Thank you. And a follow-up, please, Mr. Chair.
Do you happen to know how many companies we're talking about here? Because I read it as somewhat limited in terms of the number of companies that may be involved. And a second part, so I'll make this into one question, one really long question.
Start writing.
How much of our state's money is already invested in these particular companies? What are we talking about, a tiny piece or a significant piece? Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonamici, the answer to the second question is we have, as of February 10th, we had $292 million invested in companies. The proponents of the bill have given us a list of target companies. If this bill were to pass, clearly we'd need a third party to bring us a different list. So the list could be different. It could be longer. That list, that proposed list, had roughly 20, 24 companies on it. We were, as of February 10th, invested in 11 of them.
Thank you.
Sure.
Is one of the problems here that some of those companies are IBM, Coke, worldwide companies?
I don't know the list specifically.
Large stocks, large
Mr. Chair, they are largely in Iran. It's largely petroleum companies from other nations. So there's a Norwegian company, Italian, Spanish. What else have we got on here? Japan, Malaysia, one from China, one from Hong Kong, Brazil. I think the one that probably means the big banner company, is Royal Dutch Shell. And that's really Total SA as a French company that may ring a bell. The rest are ones that we don't hear about very often.
Because that's often the issue with some of these divestiture bills, pensions, and is that, you know, well, these same companies that do business there do business everywhere. Senator Cruz?
Yeah, well, one of the exceptions is U.S. companies that are doing business there under federal agreement, so that are authorized by the federal government. So that would probably include the IBMs of the world.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, I do. I believe that's. I have looked at some domestic oil companies, and they're not. I couldn't find evidence that they're there. I don't. You know, when you read their website, it says they aren't in Iran. There is a provision there is an exception in the sanctions that allows a company to petition the State Department for an exception.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I think that exception is talking about. I think it's difficult to get that exception.
I would think so.
Okay. I would hope so.
Any other questions?
One more follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. P, you said $292 million as of a date in February, and I'm sorry I don't know this, but what percent is that of the total amount that we're talking about?
Let me do that off
please
the top of my head, 292. It'd be right at 5 or 6%. I'm doing math in my head.
You should never do that.
We're in charge of waters here.
Yeah. The good news is at the end of February, the market had two of its worst months in history. January, February, and March was a pretty robust month. We came back quite a bit, but trying to speak towards the end of February, that's going to be right at 4 or 5%.
Well, thank you. We know you're busy. Appreciate you coming over here.
We appreciate the opportunity to testify.
We will divert. I almost said divest from this hearing, and come back to it in about an hour when the sponsors come in.
And if I could, Mr. Chair, again, just to underscore the fact that the values represented in the bill, and the heartfelt nature of the supporters. I recently sat down, had a very productive, collaborative dinner with them here recently, and I understand what they're doing and wholeheartedly support it. I just think there are better ways to do this. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So I will temporarily close the public hearing on Senate Bill 633 and go back and reopen the hearing on Senate Bill 366. And if I could, I'd like to call up the USBA, David Williams, Ken Hunsaker, and Chuck Bennett.
I could just show that. Request
is here.
What's that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kent Hunsaker with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. I'm the executive director. The testimony I'm going to give is on Senate Bill 366. I think that one of the things I want to emphasize is beware of unintended consequences of this bill. The first one is when we look at employees in the educational system in general, we have different categories of employment. So teachers go through a three-year probationary period, and then they are contracted teachers. After that, they can only be dismissed for cause under the regulations that exist under cause. Principals receive, a probationary period and then go into a three-year contract. At the end of 2 years, that contract is reviewed, and it's either renewed for a period of time or it is allowed to go out. Superintendents currently have guidelines around their contracts. They are a maximum of 3 years. And what happens in these circumstances is that we take certain things that happen where there happens to be buyouts from contracts and say we have a problem with the whole system. The unintended consequence of passing this bill would be that there would be limits on contracts for superintendents beyond what there are now, which the three would instantly go away because nobody could enter into a contract that would allow compensation for more than a year's period of time. So you could argue that, well, at least somebody's going to be there for 3 or 6 months before they decide to dismiss, so it would be longer. But imagine in this state if the disincentive for being a superintendent was that you are treated with a contract like this. Imagine that you're coming from Montana to move your family. The superintendent from Centennial did that. Came from Montana to move his family to take over that district and had a one-year contract. Your big districts in this state that often recruit from out of state, imagine if that was your limit that you could provide to them as a contract for coming in. I meet with my colleagues from all across the nation. Exactly the opposite is happening across the nation, that they're having to come up with incentives to attract superintendents to the job. There are many, and we're seeing this right now. David Williams can probably talk about OSBA. There's a lot of the superintendent searches. We have low numbers of folks applying for that position. Imagine if you're a principal in a three-year contract and you're considering being a superintendent and you're going to go take that job maybe in these financial times with a year's contract. And those things make it very difficult to attract people to the position. I think it's one of the most difficult positions to get people to go into, and one of the most difficult positions to get good qualified candidates as pools of candidates. We're seeing it more and more and more. As I was reading through the bill, I believe, it's kind of hard to say here, but I do believe that with this bill that a district could not enter into a contract for more than a year with the superintendent.
Ms. Chairman, Chuck Bennett, Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Ms. Chairman, the reason I'm up here, I've been working, as Senator Walker mentioned, with her over the past couple of sessions on these bills. And the main thing I wanted to do was to assure you that we have been working in good faith trying to find the best way to deal with employment contracts involving superintendents. And frankly, Ms. Chairman, given the nature of employment law, given the nature of how well you can fine-tune local actions around state law, I think you see the outcome in this bill. You have two sections devoted specifically to Lebanon and to Reynolds. I can assure you, Mr. Chairman, that in the future you will have sections dealing with each of the school districts that end up in disputes with their chief executive officers and go through some kind of separation, and that you just can't capture all of the possibilities that occur under these various laws. And I think a prime example is the one that Senator Cruz pointed to in terms of trying to maintain a quorum on a school board if you set up a situation where a tort claim eliminates the ability of members of the school board to be involved. So I hope, Mr. Chairman, that I believe, Mr. Chairman, that last session we found, I think, a good way to deal with this. We dealt with some of the very broad kinds of issues that come up, particularly involving relationships between retiring, and I mean that in terms of leaving executives and their school districts and the kinds of relationships they can have. But, Ms. Chairman, this is an attempt, I think, to try to deal with one kind of public employee in a school district entirely different than comparable public employees in the school district, whether they are teachers or principals or assistant principals or assistant superintendents. It's an attempt by statute to single out one employee and try to figure out a way to work with them through state law in a way different with the others. And I can just assure you, Mr. Chairman, and I know this will be to the consternation of Senator Walker, we will be back and back and back as long as this issue is driven by headlines and the unusual in this kind of employment relationship. We'd ask you not to move this bill forward, Ms. Chairman. We have a good law in place and believe that it is working as well as human nature allows most laws to work. And there are exceptions. We accept that. We hope we can continue to move forward on these kinds of issues with you. And as we see systemic problems, we'll be glad to come work with you. But as you try to legislate the particular, we think that's a mistake. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Williams.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, David Williams with the Oregon School Boards Association. Also to provide testimony in opposition to Senate Bill 366. We think the original legislation was really intended to get at those situations where you have retiring employees or long-time administrators, where there is often a very positive relationship with the school district, and you know, in some headline instances were given a generous packages upon retirement or upon leaving the district. And really, the focus we've seen of late is on these situations where the relationship has gone sour. And in those situations, it is our position that boards need as much flexibility as they can within the framework of normal tort law to be able to decease employment with that individual and whatever it takes to remove that administrator from the district. And in some instances, that does take financial incentives for many times to avoid excessive legal costs in the court down the road, as some administrators who, if they are dismissed without cause, would be entitled to certain legal remedies if a settlement agreement is not reached. And we think this really would hamper an ability of a district to have that kind of flexibility in dealing with those situations. As Mr. Bennett and Mr. Hunsker alluded to superintendent searches, we do a vast number of superintendent searches around the state for school districts through a service program at the Oregon School Boards Association, and have seen a dramatic decline in the numbers of superintendents in our search pools over the last couple of years. I think a lot of it can be directly attributable to the kind of parameters and the kind of negative atmosphere we've brought upon our administrators in the state. We're not able to recruit out of state to pull the best administrators from around the country into Oregon. As an aside, I think a part of it as well is the financial situation our school districts are in this state over the last decade, and I think if we could do something about that, maybe in some other committees we'd be in better shape as well. But I think a lot of it is also due to this atmosphere we've placed around our superintendents and our inability to provide financial incentives and guaranteed employment for these folks to come to Oregon. I also want to point to Section 1, Sub 4, the comments that Senator Cruz raised. I think they're very appropriate comments. One could very easily envision a scenario where the relationship has gone bad between an administrator and a board. An administrator could very quickly bind up that board from any action, either from termination or continuance of a contract, by simply filing a tort against three of a five-member board or four of a seven-member board, excuse me, and therefore you would lack the votes necessary to take any action against that superintendent whatsoever, and it really would hold a district a hostage in those kinds of situations as well.
Thank you. Questions? You're saying, Mr. Hunsaker, that if you're a Portland or a Eugene and you need to replace your superintendent with somebody who's got experience dealing with multi-hundred-million-dollar budgets, top-level negotiator, that you can't bring that person in from Houston or Atlanta for a one-year commitment.
That's correct. Mr. Chair, to respond to that as well, in fact, we saw, it's interesting you mentioned Houston, we saw one of our better superintendents in the state, actually, from Hillsborough, for a variety of reasons, actually did choose to take a job with a school district, a suburb of Houston, leaving the Portland area, one of our better superintendents in the state.
I can just mention one more thing. Is that when you think about employment contracts, what you desire here is to have the same thing happen with superintendents that happen with principals, that happen with teachers. And that is, you're doing something wrong, you expect to find out what that is, be given a chance to improve that, and then move forward. And as those things go on, then normally contracts are not renewed and you don't have really big settlements. Not quite sure why that didn't happen in Lebanon, because that situation had gone on for some period of time, and why that board chose to provide a three-year agreement each time, don't know. But that's the kind of thing that happens, is that you expect that to happen with any employee. We expect it with teachers, we expect it with principals, and we should expect it with superintendents. The language I'd love to see is just that, is that a board has the responsibility with the superintendent to make them aware of the things they're not doing right, provide an opportunity to improve, and then move forward with that. As long as we're doing that, we don't have these problems. It's when you get sometimes folks that are not real good at that, and somehow they keep renewing contracts that they maybe shouldn't, then these things will continue to happen.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I need to ask a clarification question, because it's not my understanding from Senator Walker's testimony that she intended to limit this to one-year contracts, but the way you interpret it, is that because the severance pay is limited to 12 months, that therefore then the contract can only be for a year?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, yes, that's the way we would interpret that. Keep in mind, then, that essentially you have inside of that, you may have a three-year agreement, but you really don't. at any time then, if you had that, that a board could only pay a superintendent for that portion of the remainder of their contract, then it really means you don't have a three-year contract with anybody. And we haven't, you know, at times I've seen some contracts where boards have said 3 months, 3 months without cause. And we've certainly advised folks that they shouldn't enter into agreements. They may have a three-year agreement, but if you're 3 months without cause, you really have a three-month agreement at any time.
Thank you.
Okay. Bill Cludien.
Chair Hawes, committee for the record, Bill Cludien, Carpenters Industrial Council. May I ask the committee why we're even here on this issue? Evidently, we have a problem. And during the testimony, the one thing that really bothers me, Chair, committee, is not once was the kids mentioned. This is our school tax dollars. All you hear is kids first, but not today, not in here. Where do we have an incentive to draw people in? If you do a bad job, you're going to win. How do you compensate somebody that does a real good job? A person can come in here 59 years old, do a good job for a year, drag his feet for a year, get fired, and walk away with extended benefits, health care. Committee, take a long look at this. If there was not a problem, we wouldn't be here today. Remember, we haven't got any money to give away. We're going to be taking money away. But let's keep our kids first. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you, Bill. Appreciate it. All right, I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 366. Okay. And then we will reopen our hearing on Senate Bill 633. I believe we have some sponsors in the queue. Senator Boquist is here.
He looks familiar.
Cripple's coming, Mr. Chair, but I'll lean if you want to for the sake of time.
Sure. You probably heard that we heard the other side of this from the Treasurer's office and earlier. And just so you know that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Senator Brian Boquist, and yes, Mr. Chair, I listened to the entire testimony of the State Treasurer. Since my good colleague's not here quite yet, I'll just kind of recap. Mr. Chair, Committee Administrator was kind enough to kind of outline at the beginning of the original hearing the parameters of the bill, and I would call to your attention that in the back of the bill, and I would normally close with this, but in section number 5, it said this does not apply to, this is important key, does not apply to subparagraph 2 companies who are authorized by the federal government to do business in Iran. The fact of the matter is we're here because the previous administration, and for the record that was the Bush administration, did not enforce the sanctions against Iran, and so therefore upwards of 20 states have taken it upon themselves to advance those sanctions at a state level to ensure we are in compliance with the federal law. I have not provided to you the packet of 33 pages I have here in my hand. That packet is the number of killed and wounded Oregon citizen soldiers, Marines, airmen who have either been killed or wounded in the battles in Iraq, regardless of whether we agree they should have gone there or not. What you do have in your packet that I just gave to you is an article from the Democrat Herald. And just to outline that very briefly, The 41st Infantry Brigade, 3,200 citizen soldiers strong, will be mobilized in the next few weeks and will serve from July of this year till July of next year in Iraq, scattered across the entire country. So our citizen soldiers will be there. At the bottom of that same page, you will notice there's another article about the Awakening Council you can read later, Mr. Chair. Just for refresh your memory, the Awakening Council is about 100,000 individuals in which we paid $300 a month for them to come to our side instead of shooting us as part of the surge. And those individuals, now we've stopped paying them, and they're beginning to shoot again. So we have 3,200 of our own going over there, and a serious situation continuing to develop. The second handout I've given to you is actually some documentation, which I won't go into. It says powerful roadside bomb at the top above it, and it goes through some documentation of arms and ammunition that has been supplied from the government or factions of the government of Iran into Iraq. Evidence is very quite clear and compelling. And for the record, I served in southern Sudan, which is why Senator Carter asked me to join two sessions ago in the Sudan sanctions bill, which again did nothing more than implement federal law. And I also served in Iraq as Deputy Commander of Special Operations. And in both instances, I sent people home in body bags. I'm quite familiar with the situation in both countries and would disagree with earlier testimony that there isn't clear and compelling evidence. The next document you have, Mr. Chair, in your packet is the letter I sent to the State Treasurer, in which I outlined that Senator Atkins and I are simply trying to enforce existing federal law at the state level. And, of course, on the back page, I extended whatever courtesy is necessary to work with the Treasurer's office to come up with whatever amendment they would like to have in the bill to ensure that we're in compliance with federal law. We unfortunately did not come to that agreement. The third document you have in your packet, Mr. Chair, is actually a letter that is probably similar to what you have already received, though I've not seen it, and it is a letter that the State Treasurer wrote to me, and I'd like to highlight several points. As he has pointed out, the State Treasurer is, in fact, the fiduciary of the Public Employees Retirement Fund. That is a very true statement. As I have pointed out, regardless of whether it's a retirement fund or not, it still must comply with federal law, and 20 states have passed laws to align it with that. He's also outlined in there an Attorney General's opinion, which is frankly quite dated, in 1993, which predates most of the present sanctions applied by the federal government. He has also outlined that we're in compliance with existing federal laws. I think that could be debatable. I think we can be within compliance. And one of the reasons we're, of course, having this discussion is if we all thought the world was perfect, we wouldn't be here. So I'll leave that one at that, considering this is on the public record. I would point out that while the Treasurer has indicated we could face legal action from some shareholders if we divested outside of the parameters of the federal law, that is quite true. I would point out that inside the parameters of the federal law, there are also things that can transpire in the state of Oregon, first of which our funds could be seized if we were found to be operating illegally. Second, intentional willful violation carries a prison sentence of 20 years under federal law, and the state could be fined millions of dollars. He has correctly, in the testimony that's before you, outlined that California did oppose, the PERS system in California did oppose this in California, which of course adopted it almost unanimously across the board in their legislature and was signed by the governor. And it did identify that there were some costs associated with complying with the federal law. I've indicated previously that I do see a distinction. There is ample evidence which I provided to the good committee in regards to Iran and Sudan and the comparisons of them. I would like to point out that it has been mentioned that the federal government is taking a different direction, that the federal government is changing, and that is absolutely correct. House Bill 1327 was introduced. It was pre-filed in the existing session of the Congress. It was introduced and put forward. It had its first hearing 4 days ago. in the House of Representatives. And considering that the chief sponsor in the House of Representatives pre-filed is Senator Barney Frank of the Finance Committee, and the hearing was held at his committee 4 days ago, I would think this bill's going someplace. And I would also think that since Senator Barack Obama and Senator Chris Todd were both large supporters of this bill, that we are taking a change. We should be expecting that the federal government will start complying with its own laws, similar to what we would expect the state to comply with laws of the federal government. The next document I'd point out in the packet, and I won't go into reading, and if you really need bedtime insomnia, you can read this, especially in the fine print. But you have a copy of the Office of Foreign Asset Control regulations outlining the sanctions against Iran and all of the supporting documentation. And again, I remind you that the last page of the bill we have in here basically says that we want the state of Oregon to comply with the federal law, and anything within the federal law that is exempted here. It is an interesting read if you're into legal stuff. The second document you have is a document from Office of Foreign Asset Control, which is from Sudan. It's the Sudan sanctions, and many of you might have seen this because this was out on the floor when we passed this bill last time. Its authorities and sanctions aren't a whole lot different than what's in Iran. Almost to the last document, or in fact it is the last document that you have, is a flyer that I provided for you that is done based on due diligence and given to fiduciary individuals responsible for the fiduciary actions across the nation. And it's entitled Risk Factors for OFAC Compliance in the Securities Industry. And I did provide this to the State Treasurer's Office so that we would all be on the same sheet of music of what is expected under the federal law and what we should comply with. And with that, Mr. Chair, I think I've said enough, and I'll turn it over to my good senior senator.
Senator Atkinson, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jason Atkinson, state senator from Southern Oregon. Apologize for the tardiness. I thought we were on different time, but let me just get right to the heart of the matter. I did have reviewed some of the objections to the bill, and I also know that my colleague has briefed the committee on the bill. Very quickly, the two main reasons that have come up for opposition for the bill have simply been that you could not draw a direct line between business activities and sponsoring genocide, and that a new administration would wish to change diplomatic strategies. The only thing I would say in both of those cases is that those were the same two arguments were made for Oregon not to divest in companies that were part of South Africa during apartheid. It was both of those exact same reasons of not to do something, that there was fear that the policy-setting branch of government, which is the legislative branch of government, would not do that because a new administration was going to take a different tact and that there was no clear link. Now, we do know that history was proven considerably different. I did hear briefly some comments that were made regarding genocide, and I will tell you that those comments, while perhaps made in earnest, were perhaps not accurate. My experience in not only in Iraq but in the region would suggest just the opposite. In fact, the actions that are taken against their own people, much in the same way as happened in Iraq, is not only a threat to the Kurdish population, but is also a direct threat to the Jewish population. Israel has main concerns with the direct link between doing business and companies that currently employ people, currently invest, and currently support the regime that is currently upheld in Iran. Now, I will say there's a significant difference between the people of Iran and their government. In fact, I think that the current government probably will have difficulties managing its own people over the course of time. But to have such broad-based statements that were made in opposition to this bill, first of all, is not at all consistent with the legislative policy-making branch of government. And secondly, it is not at all consistent with the reasons that this policymaking branch of government decided to deinvest in companies that were doing business in South Africa during apartheid or during the regime that we saw in Sudan. Now, there is some concern with, I believe it was subsection 5 of the bill, which simply states, and what we try to do with this bill is to simply have federal law being upheld. There was some talk about proxy voting and some other things that were proven to be effective when it came to greenhouse gases and sustainability. I can tell you that working in the Middle East, there is no thought of greenhouse gases or of sustainability. The reason that there is a very hostile government in this particular part of the world as it relates to not only its neighbors, but also to Israel and also to its own populations in the region, has got nothing to do or would pay absolutely zero attention to proxy voting or some of the other alternatives that we heard. I think this is a very solid and a very consistent piece of policy for the state of Oregon. I know that in one state, I believe it has been New Jersey, has adopted a similar mechanism. New Jersey has significantly larger bills and investments with their public retirement system and has significantly more ability to get the attention than perhaps a slower, more gradual approach that has been suggested by the executive branch of government here in Oregon. I believe that this piece of legislation will be introduced in other parts of the United States, much the same way that when Oregon led an apartheid, a small groundswell swept in other state legislatures. Did we have an effect in ending apartheid? I think that's a question that we can debate. Did we do morally the right thing? Yes. Is this a moral bill? Is this bill morally the right thing to do? Yes. I would urge an aye vote.
Thank you both. I appreciate you bringing this bill forward. I know you both have experience in that part of the world. Let's talk about Section 5 for a moment because it has raised some questions. It seems to be the nut here. Maybe you could just clarify for no one else in my mind. Investments in the United States companies that are authorized by the federal government to do business in Iran. Does that mean then that the IBMs and the Coca-Colas, then the FIRST Fund would not have to sell its IBM stock?
Mr. Chair.
Is that the intent?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist again. Under the federal law, which is covered in this slight brochure, this right here that is in very fine print that us old people can't hardly read without our bifocals, it does outline it. In fact, it states that companies, such international companies that are from other countries that we don't have a direct impact in, we don't have to divest in. Right? Those are accepted. Are exceptions under federal law. As you know, Coca-Cola is not Coca-Cola. There's Coca-Cola USA. There's Coca-Cola all over the place. And if I was representing Bruce Hanna, I could tell you all the rest of the Coca-Cola story, but I'm not a distributor, so I can't give that to you. But the other thing that is interesting under existing federal law, which is part of a change that is not part of the ongoing federal legislation, is that oil companies with less than $20 million in investment in Iran do not have to be divested. I say that again. That is another exception under the federal law. Everything that is outlined in Section 5, Mr. Chair, is consistent with existing federal law, and we're supposed to be, I say again, Mr. Chair, we're supposed to be complying with already. But again, the Bush administration chose not to enforce compliance, which is why Representative Frank and others are continuing to push forward to get us in compliance with that law, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonavici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senators, for being here and for your testimony. I just would like a clarification. That's my understanding that this deals with direct investment in the 20 or so companies that are at issue. So say, for example, there's a fund where there's a piece that wouldn't be included. It's direct investment in the company. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, it is direct investment except U-turn and third party, for a better word, third-hand investments under the federal law, which means if your hand was involved, so as example, you couldn't go have those discussions that were raised here earlier. You can't go with your proxy vote and have discussions with them about it because communications are banned under the federal law. The arm's length ones would not be banned presently under federal law, to my understanding, and I can seek a clarification from the U.S. Treasury on that. To and follow up, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator.
Any other questions? Thank you both.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. I do have Bob Livingston signed up here.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Bob Livingston, representing the Oregon State Firefighters Coalition and also the PERS Coalition, which represents approximately 250,000 members of the that are currently active or retired within the public employees retirement system. And in its current form, I believe we have many questions and have concerns with respect to this piece of legislation. And while I do respect the sponsors of this bill, some of the things that I think are worth mentioning today is that, first, if you were to go back and look at the issue with respect to divestiture with South Africa and our apartheid, it was a long process. It was one that we certainly opposed at the time, and because of our opposition to it, I think there was, over time, there was strategies that were put in place that did two things. One, it did what I believe Senator Atkinson said it did, but it did it in a deliberate and thoughtful process, one without emotions, one that was based on sound investments and how do we address, you know, the issue of moral issues and those kind of things, but also the issue that I think is also being lost in this a little bit, and that's the issue of, you know, there is a fiduciary responsibility for the Oregon Investment Council. As a member that is a PERS recipient, they have a responsibility to me to make sure that they are making prudent and sound investments. And I think you heard it, but I think it's been lost in some of the emotional context. And clearly I understand the emotional context, and we'll speak to that here shortly, is if you, and forgive the pun, if you have a fire sale, in essence, and take the tools away from the Oregon Investment Council and simply require divestiture, how do we effectuate change? And some examples of that is Oregon's, the OIC, the pension fund, is over a $42 billion fund. It's one of the largest public sector funds in the nation. And with that, not only does there come responsibility, but there becomes leverage. And some examples that we've done in the past is on policies, whether it was, you know, and you asked for some examples, R.J. Reynolds and some of their practices, because of the fact that the Oregon Investment Council is a major player in the investment world, they were able to effectuate some positive changes. One question I think you need to ask yourself is that if you simply do a full divestiture and don't give them the tools to sit down with these companies and to address some of these issues that I think we're all in agreement are important to all of us. They're important to not only Oregon, but to the world that we live in. I would wonder whether we're actually doing things that's consistent with some of the things that I heard, particularly with the change in the administration. You know, as an example, the last administration, you know, refused to sit down and even have a discussion with Iran. I think there's been some communications to try to address that. Again, those are issues for the federal government, I believe. It's difficult for here. We have a lot of difficulties here in Oregon with the state budgets, with other things. And while this is an important piece of legislation, you know, are we being consistent with what our federal government is trying to do? And I'm not quite sure if we are on that. Another question specifically to that fiduciary responsibility is that of those companies that are listed, what do we do in Section 5 of the bill? OIC invests not only in United States companies, they invest worldwide in several companies. And so if we had a list, how often is that list updated? Would that mean you'd have to change if they are invested here and then all of a sudden having to do that? So just just the process we would have concerns and questions with. The next argument, if I may make, that I would at least like some answers to is really, is this a little bit of a slippery slope? You know, really, where does it end? And while, you know, we're attentive to immoral issues, you know, as an example, China, you know, they cleaned up their act during the Olympics a little bit, but there's many examples in China to this day on human rights issues, particularly with women and how they're treated. Will there, the next legislature, will somebody bring forward a bill that says we need to divest from China? What would the impacts be of that? And I say that in all seriousness, and I do appreciate the sponsors' concerns, and while, you know, I'm not making jest of this. You know, these actions do have impacts from a fiduciary responsibility as well as just an overall investment opportunity that we do. As an example, you know, if labor was to come next time and say, OIC, we want you to divest in, you know, your stock in Walmart because they have poor labor relations and they continue to be fined by the federal government, you know, would we be doing those things? And so I think those are some of the questions and concerns that I have with that. Specifically addressing the global economy and the issues of the federal legislation, just to keep in mind, it's my understanding that PERS has to always make sure that they're in compliance with federal law. Mr. Cleary could, who is the director of PERS, each year each biennium, you have to approve a PERS bill that makes sure that they're in compliance with IRS and other federal provisions. So to me, it seems like that, I'm not sure what's going on there, but I think they do have to be that, in compliance. Additionally, I think under the Patriot Act and Homeland Security, and this is an issue that where I want to bring it back to, while I understand and appreciate Senator Boquist, who's been in country, in Iraq, even though this bill deals with Iran, I think it's my understanding is that we do have laws at the federal level that if there's known terrorism or if monies that are going to terrorists, whether it's funneled through companies or corporations and these kind of things, that the federal government can step in and stop that. And while I get a little bit nervous about giving this as an example, I think arguably there's no group, and while let's be clear, it was Al-Qaeda that attacked us on 9/11. I think there's no other group that understands the importance of making sure that, you know, we're safe here and that we're making sound judgments. And the firefighters who lost 343 members on that day in 9/11. And so we do take some of the issues and the concerns that I think you'll hear from the proponents' bill as serious as anybody. And so finally, if I could close on that, I just think it's really important that we understand the ramifications of what we're doing here. We are in a global economy. There's lots of companies out there that invest. And it's important to me that we're not only being conscientious, but we also make sure that the OIC has the best track record out of anybody out there. Mr. Cleary and PERS, while we're having a downturn in the economy, unlike some state governments and state pension RAN systems, even though they've had a significant loss, we're in much better shape than many other states. And I'd like to think one of the reasons why is that we have a model investment track record. And any time, I guess, to close it up, get concerned about tweaks and ramifications. And I'd be interested to hear from really some of the members from the OIC, and I think you heard it on behalf of the Treasurer, that there are concerns with that. And with that, Mr. Chair, we do appreciate, and we know this is a sensitive subject. We understand the emotional side of this, but we would just urge you to please make sure these things are addressed, and let's go slow. And you know, while we don't support this current piece of legislation, if with a little more work, we would certainly look at it. But right now, there's a lot of unintended consequences and a lot of questions that we have as a coalition. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Thank you, Bob.
Thanks.
Ken Quartler and Bob Hornstein.
For the record, I'm Robert Hornstein. I'm the Community Relations Director for the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, first of all, thank you for this opportunity to speak. We understand the time limitation, and we will try to be brief. I think there's a few points that are important to raise. I want to mention that Senator Bonamici asked a question about the number of states. It's our understanding that 15 states have passed similar legislation, including California, Florida, Illinois, Pennsylvania, New Jersey. I want to talk about this from two perspectives. Very briefly, the moral issue that this bill addresses. Iran, as you all know, is one of the most repressive regimes in the world with an abysmal human rights record. It is a sponsor of terrorism through its proxies, Hamas and Hezbollah, that have affected not only Israel, as we heard Senator Atkinson talk about, but also the West. We've had American soldiers killed by actions, terrorist actions against them that were perpetrated by Hezbollah, for example. And we have a country that is a radical Islamic fundamentalist regime that is in pursuit of nuclear weapons that, should they succeed, we believe would destabilize the entire region, and I don't think that's a road that we want to go down. We heard today that we are invested $292 million in 11 companies that support the terrorist infrastructure of Iran. I think we want to make a statement that that's not something we would permit. As far as the fiduciary arguments, I think these are important. I want you to understand that we would be interested in narrowing the scope of this bill so that it targets only those foreign companies that are investing at least $20 million in Iran's energy sector, its oil and gas sector. The reason that this bill is broader based was actually at the suggestion of then candidate for state treasurer Ben Westland, whom we met with, that sought a broader bill and was supportive at the time that he was a candidate, but has obviously now changed his position. So we would be interested in narrowing the scope of the bill, because there is a list of companies, for example, that Florida used that was put together by the U.S. Library of Congress and the Department of Energy that consists of no more than 24 companies, and it's in your packet. These companies, what's important to understand, are already sanctionable under federal law, under the 1996 Iran Sanctions Act. If these companies were to be sanctioned, their stock would be adversely impacted, obviously resulting in a loss to the state pension system. And by the way, on a personal note, I am a PERS member. I worked for the state for 10 years. Right now, in addition to seeking diplomatic engagement with Iran, which the Obama administration is pursuing, they are also talking about looking for ways to tighten economic sanctions against Iran, including sanctioning these particular companies that are on that list. So why would we stay invested in these companies when you can sell them and invest them in equally profitable energy companies that are not liable for sanction? That would appear to us to make sound fiduciary sense. I also want to mention, in an answer to a question that was raised by Senator Bonamici, is our understanding, if the language needs to be tightened up in the bill, that we're not talking about commingled index funds. We're talking about direct investment in these companies. And then I want to mention House Bill 1327 that was introduced in this Congress by Barney Frank, the Iran Sanctions Enabling Act, that would preclude litigation against states that have divested from these companies investing in Iran's energy sector. I want to mention that not only was Barack Obama a supporter of this bill, he was actually one of the chief sponsors of the bill in the last Congress. It did pass the House last time around and got hung up in the Senate, but the expectation is that it will pass this time around. And I'll let Ken go from there.
Thank you, Mr. Thank Chairman, you. Senators. For the record, my name is Ken Kortler. I'm here on behalf of the Community Relations Committee of the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland. I thank you very much for your time and attention today. Bob Hornstein has, I think, done a pretty good job of summarizing the reasons that Iran is a huge problem for us, but I think perhaps the greatest one hasn't been mentioned yet, and that is quite simply that Iranian weaponry, the training that Iran has been providing to Iraqi insurgents, is responsible not just for the deaths of many American service people, but for many Oregonians as well. And I think it's absolutely untenable to think that our own state funds are helping to support a regime that is directly responsible for the killing of Oregonians in the service of the U.S. military. I'm going to just try and touch on a few points here because I know we're short on time. We've talked a bit about fiduciary obligations. We've seen some memos that were issued both by Attorney General Frohmeyer and Attorney General Kulongoski that the Treasurer has provided that talk about what exactly is the fiduciary obligation of the trustees of the fund. It is to maximize the benefit and the interest of the beneficiaries of the fund, of the PERS members like the gentleman sitting to my right. Now, benefit and interest is not merely something that can be expressed in terms of the numbers on a financial balance sheet. I doubt that anyone would feel as though their benefit and interest is being served if at the same time their funds may be profiting, their lives are becoming less secure, their neighbors are endangered, and world peace is put significantly at issue. I would also argue in terms of there are certain limits that any fiduciary obligation carries. And the obligation to maximize returns goes only so far. If we were simply looking at the ultimate, the greatest returns we could get, perhaps we ought to be investing in Somali pirates these days or Colombian drug cartels, which are perhaps on a par of legitimacy with the Iranian regime at this point. And obviously, we're not willing to do that. I don't think anyone who is a PERS member wants blood money in their trust funds. I would argue that because of the increasingly risky investments that these present, that currently the Oregon Investment Council and the state treasurer may well be in breach of their fiduciary obligations by keeping them in the fund. These funds have been identified and targeted, as you've heard, by a number of states, cities, organizations, college endowments, and the like. People are pulling money out of them. They are invested in an area of the world that is increasingly turbulent. I could not even, unfortunately, rule out the possibility of significant military activity going on in that region in the next few years. Those are therefore very poor and highly risky investments. And even without this bill, I would contend that the fiduciary obligation on OIC and the Treasurer obliges them to divest in any event. I think that this bill gives them additional justification for doing it and additional protection from whatever legal consequences they are concerned about in that regard. The bill also explicitly states that the divestment must be done in a manner consistent with ORS 293, which sets out itself the fiduciary obligation. So I think the bill is entirely consistent with that statutory obligation. One or two other quick points, the administrative costs. The Treasurer has cited a very large figure for potential administrative costs to this. Now, we already know what the administrative costs are because, as people have pointed out, we had a Sudan divestment bill which has been in effect for 3 years. Surely the Treasurer's office is familiar with what costs were involved in it. I regret that he didn't choose to provide that detail. California enacted a bill very similar to this 15 months ago. We should know by now what exactly their costs were. Of course, their numbers will be much higher because their funds are much larger. He hasn't provided those either. What he has provided, the $100 million figure that he has featured in his literature, is an estimate provided before the bill passed in California, and it was furnished by opponents of the bill. It is, therefore, in my opinion, one of the least credible, least relevant, and least reliable figures we could be discussing here. We've put in our papers, and I won't go into them in detail, all of the reasons why, in our opinion, these divestments are common and ordinary financial transactions of a nature that are practiced regularly by financial professionals. They should not incur any kind of significant additional costs. We've heard a bit today about proxy voting and about how we would lose our influence in some of these companies by divesting ourselves of the stock. These companies are on the firing line. They've been on the firing line now for 4 or 5 or 6 years. As I mentioned before, they are being targeted for divestment and sanction and penalty by the U.S. Congress, by various states. If all of that influence has not been enough to persuade them that they are invested in the wrong places, I really doubt that a proper conversation between the OIC and that company will accomplish anything more. I would also tell you that as someone who has served as in-house senior counsel to two Fortune 500 companies over the course of 14 years, that companies are far more vulnerable to brand pressure from the outside on controversial issues than they are from pressure from within with regard to shareholders and proxy fights. I've never worked for a company that was nearly as concerned with what might happen at a shareholders meeting, because they can control the agendas very effectively at those. They're much more concerned about the protesters out there at their gate or the bad press that they'll be receiving for what they're doing and invested in. Finally, with the question of where does it stop, I think it stops in any situation where the fiduciary is determined that it's a reasonable investment to leave the money where it is. And I have difficulty imagining how this can be viewed as a reasonable, safe, and non-risky investment at this point in time. And I think whatever country that may be in at a given moment, I think the fiduciary, the trustees, the OIC, and the treasurer are obliged to act. I thank you very much for your time and attention.
Thank you, gentlemen. Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you. I don't have a question, but just in an overabundance of caution and wanting to make clear for the record that my husband serves on the executive committee of the Community Relations Committee. That will not affect the way that I view this bill, however. I just want to put that on the record.
I appreciate your abundance of clarity on that. Thank you both.
Thank you.
If that's everyone who has signed up, we'll close a hearing.
Mr. Chair, before
Senator Cruz.
As one of the sponsors of this bill, I'd just like to say that I find it troubling that we can make a differentiation between what happened in Sudan and what's happening in Iran at this point in time. And I find it incredible to assume that the activities of our small piece of investment in Iran is going to influence anything that goes on in that country, because it will not. They could actually probably care less, but it just troubles me that we would continue to invest in a company that's killing our people, or a country that's killing our people, and they are. And that's indisputable. And they are trying to become nuclear, and they are one of the greatest dangers in the world. And for us to say that divesting in Sudan because of their atrocities is appropriate and not doing this divestiture because we don't know is beyond the pale, because this is absolutely the right thing to do.
Thank you, Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a phrase that hasn't been used, but I can't get it out of my head. It doesn't feel very good. It's called blood money. And I just, I mentioned earlier that I had seen that 60-minute piece last night, and I can't get it out of my head. It's just not the kind of principles that we want to live by. There are not words to describe the actions that are going on in that country.
Mr. Chair, just one more thing. Our divestiture isn't going to change what goes on in Iran. It's just not a game we should be playing in, period.
Okay, I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 633, and we're going to come back to this country.
Okay.
And an open hearing on Senate Bill 903. And Senator Morris, this is your bill. And I know that you have gone through a couple iterations and thought processes, and maybe you could walk us through those.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, I'm Frank Morris, State Senator, District 8, Albany and Corvallis areas. This bill originated following the interim committee that the Senate Interim Education Committee, when we talked about the golden parachute issue at Reynolds and at Lebanon. And I, as a member of that committee, expressed considerable displeasure at the magnitude of the agreement with the superintendent in Lebanon, and felt that there was, maybe justification to think about how can we address this issue in a constructive way. Following that hearing, continuing to think about the issue, realizing that there, when you have a problem that leads to the buyout of a contract, there are almost always two sides to the issue. And subsequent to that, I had the opportunity, through the good graces of Representative Sherry Springer, who was a board member at Lebanon at the time, to arrange a meeting with Jim Robinson, the superintendent, who was the subject of the buyout. And listening to the other side of the issue, you come to the conclusion that while you have a disagreement and a conflict, it's not just one side, but it's quite often both sides. And listening to that led me to believe that maybe we could preclude some of these instances from occurring in the future if we had, the first thought that came to mind was if we had better training for our board members so that they understand their roles and responsibilities, what's appropriate, what's not appropriate, and that might work to lessen the chance that you would have a conflict and a subsequent expense to the district in a buyout. After working with the OSBA, I would paraphrase the comments, is that training is very important. It's something that they presently offer, and that in the instance of the problem in Lebanon, the training, mandatory training requirement, in fact, probably would not address the issue. That then led to the Dash 2 concept that I would like to just read the definition of the problem, so to speak, that came from Steve Druckenmiller when we reviewed this with him, and I have not submitted this for your bill files. And he's the Linn County clerk. And this is what he responded back to us, in which we had, in fact, submitted, basis upon which we submitted the Dash 2 amendments. After discussion, it is evident that training will not, in all cases, resolve issues resulting from the inability of a school district board to utilize cooperation and compromise in addressing school district-related problems and policy. This polarizing set of circumstances can arise from factors ranging from irreconcilable philosophical differences to an unwillingness to communicate based upon personal distrust. As a result, over a period of time, members can become more entrenched in their positions as the board continually grows more ineffective in conducting the business of the district. When this occurs, employees of the district can find themselves enveloped in a hostile work environment, and educators can find themselves having to battle against an unstable teaching environment. As a consequence, significant harm can be inflicted on the quality of education received by the students of the district and further burden taxpayers with wasteful expenditures associated with grievances, attorney fees, and failing school curriculums. A school board that recognizes it is at an impasse and that it has devolved to a level of inability to effectively conduct the district's business should have the option to act in the public's interest to remove the community harm and avoid likely multiple election costs generated by piecemeal recall elections that resolve little. In an attempt to provide the board members the opportunity to heal the district's discourse and resolve the public's lack of confidence without the necessity of board members surrendering their beliefs, we propose that ORS 255.335 notwithstanding the following amendments to Senate Bill 903, and those amendments generally fall along the lines of allowing a board to make that determination of its ineffectiveness and make a declaration of termination of their offices and call for a new board to to be put into place. And, Mr. Chairman and colleagues, I'm not here today to ask you to advance this bill. And that's a strange place to be in as a legislator, because when we file something, generally we'd like to see the fruits of the labor. But this bill is not ready. But I would suggest that we continue in the interim to explore this issue of how do you deal with a rogue board. Clearly, a board that is not serving the community and is not serving the students is a matter of interest to the state of Oregon, as a matter of public policy. And how you deal with that in an effective way and bring the players together, including, the Department of Education has an interest in this. The Oregon School Board Association has an interest. COSA has an interest. How do you deal with that issue? And I think it's an open-ended question that is worthy of time that we would spend in the interim trying to find solutions. Clearly, I still would be somewhat offended with $400,000 buyouts. But that was precipitated, in my judgment, by actions of the board. And it did not lie exclusively with the superintendent in that case. So how do we move this forward in a constructive way is a subject that needs more deliberation, and I would ask that we entertain this as we move into the interim, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate the opportunity to share this issue. I just wish that we had a solution that was the best solution.
Thank you, Senator Morse. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make a brief comment. I know we're short on time, but thank you, Senator Morse, for bringing this forward and for explaining the background and what you'd like to see from this bill. One of the comments that I want to make is just to make sure that wherever this takes us, that we don't do anything to create too much of a disincentive for people to run for a school board position, because it's a tremendous amount of work, often thankless, for little money, if any.
Kind of like us.
I just don't want to create barriers to that would discourage people from really stepping up to serve in that role. So I appreciate the concerns that have been raised and hope that we can find a way to address those without discouraging people from serving on boards.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, I agree 100%. If you have a board that is not working properly, very difficult to attract candidates to run in that environment as well. So there's just a whole host of issues surrounding these problems. Thank you.
Thank you. There is an issue about what to do with rogue school boards, and we haven't even figured out what to do with our rogue senator. Oh, he's from Rome. Okay. Given the declarations that Senator Morris made about his bill and not moving forward, do I still have some people who want to testify against this bill? The school boards? Tricia? Okay.
We got our per diem.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll be brief. Good afternoon, Chair Hassan, members. For the record, I am Tricia Yates, Associate Executive Director for Legislative and Public Affairs with the Oregon School Boards Association. With me is Randy Harnish with our Legal and Policy Services Department. As you know, OSBA represents the 1,400 volunteer, no compensation, elected education leaders in the state's 198 school districts, 20 education service districts, and 17 community colleges in Oregon. We're here today to talk for information on the Dash 2 Amendment to Senate Bill 903. Oregon school board members proudly represent the constituents who elect them to be the local education leaders responsible for setting policy around school and student conduct, budget, and operations of schools. Our members care deeply about working together as boards and with school leaders, staff, parents, and their communities to support the achievement of their students. They have a tough job, particularly as volunteers who have other careers as livelihoods, but it's a rewarding one in guiding our most important resource, our children and their future. OSBA was formed 60 years ago by our members as an association primarily for advocacy and professional development. So as Senator Morse noted, we provide training opportunities year-round for our members and a sequence of training courses that progress over several levels from basic to master boardsmanship. Our members train as individuals and or as whole boards. They care about their professional development, and it's a tribute to them that as volunteers, they engage in significant training and growth opportunities annually. Across our 235 locally elected boards, we have many, many success stories. And as with any elected unit of government, we also have a handful of boards that are challenged. OSBA works with member boards at their request to help them understand their role as policy setters who are to set the district's vision, mission, and priorities. We work with them on such subjects as roles and responsibilities, how to conduct effective meetings, trust in school climate, conflict management, communication skills, or also called dealing with people you can't stand, leadership skills, board self-evaluation, operating agreements. So we cover a lot of ground for those kind of conflicts that arise again in a handful of boards that have some problems. In many cases, this consultation is successful. Sometimes boards continue to struggle. Certainly, board members at an impasse could resign. We believe that current law is functioning well for many, many school districts, all but a handful. Ultimately, voters can resort to changing boards through elections or may use the existing recall system. And, Mr. Chair, I know that we're short of time. We do have a comparison that Randy has done on current law, recall election law, as well as this amendment.
Okay. Ms. Tarnish, would you be able to just submit that to us? And
absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Appreciate that. We'll have it in the record. It'll be entered.
Appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chair and members.
Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
All right. I'm going to close the hearing on, Jen Coleman. Did you still want to testify?
I will just very briefly, because ours is a different issue.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, I'm Jan Coleman. I'm with the Oregon County Clerks Association. And our concern, actually, I mean, we totally agree with education, so training is great. Our concern is that this is being put on the primary election. Primary election, if you put this race on a primary election, the school boards are going to end up paying about twice what they've been paying for an election. Okay, so we want to bring that to your attention. Also, the thing you need to be aware of is every 4 years in a primary presidential election, probably they're going to be actually more undervotes where someone doesn't vote because they're more concerned with the president and the state races, et cetera, than they would be with the school board on this election. So those are just the things we wanted to bring to your attention.
Okay. I appreciate you bringing that forward, and we'll be considerate moving forward.
Okay.
More considerate. Thank you. And now I'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 903. And we are going to move to Senate Bill 695 for a hearing on school breakfast. I should let those of you who are interested in 871 know that we're going to have to postpone that to another day because we've run late. So I'm going to open up a hearing on Senate Bill 695.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 695 does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and I regret to inform you we do not have a fiscal impact statement for it today. It requires school districts that make breakfast accessible to provide breakfast to all students who are eligible for free or reduced price lunches at no charge. Has additional provisions that I suspect Senator Dingfelder may speak to. It does declare an emergency and would take effect July 1st, 2009.
Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And may I invite Patty Whitney Wise up to join me, please, because I will have to leave to go back to Portland for commitment, and I know she can answer any questions.
Why don't we
very
bring
easily.
The whole panel up?
Okay.
And, committee, you know this is a referral to Ways and Means, so our job here is to look at the policy and let the budget writers decide whether the money is there for this.
So thank you, Chair House and members of the committee. I am Jackie Dingfelder, State Senator for District 23, and really appreciate the opportunity to testify on behalf of this bill, Senate Bill 695. a bill which will increase access to breakfast for thousands of Oregon's children. At one time, as I'm sure you know, Oregon was the hungriest state in the nation. Today, we've thankfully relinquished that title, but we are still one of the top five hungriest states. In my role as a member of the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force, I've learned that many working families who qualify for reduced price meals at school cannot always afford to pay for both breakfast and lunch. Frequently, these families are forced to choose between buying one or the other, and most choose to pay for lunch. Ultimately, this means far too many of Oregon's children go without breakfast every day. Hunger is not unique to any one part of Oregon. It is unfortunately found in each corner of our state, from Pendleton to Brookings and Burns to Astoria. Last year, over 200,000 people ate meals from an emergency food box each month in Oregon. Another 4 million emergency meals were served at soup kitchens and shelters, and sadly, over one-third of all Oregonians receiving food last year were children. Childhood hunger is a problem that reverberates throughout a child's life. It contributes to poor school attendance, lower academic achievement, and increased behavioral problems. Moreover, children who skip breakfast are more likely to be overweight, have nutritional deficiencies, and even have a higher incidence of tooth decay. However, we have an opportunity to strengthen an efficient and proven method to combat childhood hunger and its attendant problems. We can invest in the school breakfast program. So, in just briefly, the school breakfast program is currently underutilized by students from low-income families who must contribute a breakfast copay for a modest investment, and we know the times are tight, and certainly have no illusions that you're being asked, as am I in my committee, to send things to Ways and Means. But, however, this is a really good investment for a very, very small amount. For this modest or small investment, the legislature can help many more Oregon children receive the nutritional and educational benefits of eating breakfast. And at the same time, we can leverage additional federal funds. As outlined in this bill, Patty Whitney Wise, who's chair of the Hunger Relief Committee, will go into a little bit more detail, but basically for a very small state supplement for each breakfast, we can bring in a lot more federal dollars, and I think Patty's going to talk a little bit more about this. So eliminating the breakfast copay has shown to greatly increase participation among students in the reduced price category. For instance, when Washington adopted a similar measure, the state saw a 45% increase in qualified students participating in the school breakfast program. There is every reason to believe that Oregon will experience a comparable result, and for all these reasons, I ask for your support of this bill. I do want to say before I leave and hand it over to the rest of the panel that this is one of our key pieces of legislation. I'm sure you know every session the Hunger Relief Task Force identifies what we think are the top issues and how we can best address hunger and the problems facing children and families in Oregon. So this did rise to the top. Of course, we were putting this together towards last year when we didn't know we would be in as big of a hole as we are now, but certainly understand that. However, we also know that the demands are growing and food banks are being overwhelmed in the state right now. So this is one way we can help leverage those federal funds and help relieve that burden on working families. So with that, if I may, Mr. Chair, I'd like to hand it over to the certified smart folks next to me, and I once again appreciate the time and consideration of this committee.
Thank you, Senator Dingfelter. Any questions? Do you have to run?
I do.
Can you hang with us?
You're in able hands with these two right here. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. My name is Patty Whitney Wise. I'm the director for the Hunger Relief Task Force, and I appreciate the opportunity to be before you. Senator Dingfelter very ably covered most of the pertinent information. I think maybe a couple of things to add. You heard her mention that we're beginning to fall again and back into one of the hungriest states in the country. We really hate to see that happening. It has a lot to do with economics for families and what they're able to afford to put on their tables. This bill really would help many of those families who are falling on hard times right now because of the economic downturn. Studies have shown that children who eat breakfast have better behavior in the classroom, score better on tests, and do better overall in school, not to mention the help with that providing these meals has with them eating good nutrition and avoiding things like obesity. The return on investment for about $2.29 million, we would bring in over $4.2 million in federal dollars in addition to that investment that would go to the schools to provide meals for these kids and not only then help those children and those families, but also help our agricultural industry. So we urge your support.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Reagan Gray. I'm a policy analyst for Children First for Oregon, and I'd like to express our support for Senate Bill 695. For some children, school may be the only place that they receive a meal, and eliminating the copay barrier will ensure that these kids start the day with a full stomach, healthier, and better able to learn. For many children, they do not eat a nutritious breakfast every morning, and often families are living on very tight budgets and cannot afford to provide good breakfast at home every day, nor the money for them to be able to purchase it at school. In Oregon, only 24% of the eligible reduced-price kids are eating breakfast, and passing Senate Bill 695 will eliminate this copay barrier and make school breakfast accessible for children and families that are really struggling to make ends meet. In the United States, one out of six children live in a food-insecure household, not always knowing where they're going to find their next meal. Let's make sure that Oregon kids know that they can find their meal at school. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. John?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Very briefly, John Steubenwald, Director of Advocacy for Oregon Food Bank. We're just here to add our voices of support for this legislation. This is one of three top priorities for Oregon Food Bank this legislative session. As others have said, this is a top concern because one of the things that Oregon Food Bank finds in its surveys, in our surveys, is that children are disproportionately represented in those who eat from emergency food boxes in Oregon. Survey we did about a year ago shows that about 36% of those who eat from emergency food boxes in the state are in fact under 18 years old. The percentage of children in our state overall is less than 24%. So we're seeing a very strongly, disproportionately high percentage of children who are suffering from hunger as evidenced by eating from emergency food boxes. This is a good way, obviously, to get nutritional meals to children 5 days a week. We urge your support.
Thank you.
And greetings, Chairman Haas and members of the committee. My name is Noreen Goplin. I live at Welch's, Oregon. I'm the director of Lutheran Advocacy Ministry and the lead convener of the Oregon Faith Roundtable Against Hunger. Just very briefly, I'd like to say to you that we see this as one of the very effective ways to address hunger among children. We have worked very closely with school districts in terms of their food policies. We have studied this very carefully because many of our congregations throughout the state are being overwhelmed, as are the food banks, with requests from people who are hungry. It is a very unique time in the state of Oregon, and I have prepared a statement that perhaps you can read later, a little story about leaving from Welch's, Oregon, and stopping for the school bus. So I have hope you have time to see it.
Well,
thank you.
Thank you, Noreen. Appreciate your testimony and appreciate all you do. Any questions? Committee, we had hoped to go into a work session to refer this to Ways and Means. We don't have the proper paperwork yet, so we cannot do that.
Just as a question,
Senator Morris.
Mr. Chair. If we're referring it to Ways and Means, why do we need to have an opinion before we refer it?
We have
it's the rules of the president.
What's being called now a hall pass, even to do that, because that was my first question, too.
Okay.
That's the rules.
We'll comply.
We'll comply. And
we'll
do that as soon as our next opportunity.
Can I ask a question, Mr. Chair?
Senator Bonamici?
You were committee members who have more experience with the Ways and Means process.
If in fact this brings in more money than it costs, how does legislative fiscal address that when they're doing the fiscal analysis?
It still takes general fund money to bring in that money.
Right.
So it's not what it brings in, it's what we have to spend.
It's
so
new
that's
spending.
What they will.
We spend it anyway. And
well, you have to spend $2.2
right.
million to get the 4.2.
Right.
So it's part of the general fund that we have to spend. It's that much of it that's
right.
going on.
Understand.
So I mean, you can't weigh.
Thank you, Pat.
You can't look at the both pieces.
It is an attractive match. So with that, if there is no other business, we are adjourned.